How's your tea?
Delightful.
Yeah. Needed that.
Yeah.
So we've just established that you can get so hot that you can sweat twice. Where do we go from here?
Well, let me just get on top of my notes and I'll tell you.
I actually have a question for you.
Please do while we do that.
We've been fired up by the Great Fire.
Yeah.
Was where we were. Mm. I want to know from you, how did the Great Fire change London?
A great deal is my answer to
okay.
you. And that is definitely the question to ask at this point. It's the most significant thing probably to ever happen to the makeup of the city. Before the fire, London was still a sort of Middle Ages sort of town with the legacy of, you know, a medieval history too. Warren-like streets, overhanging wood buildings, all that, you know.
Clustered together.
Yeah. Picture, you know, Chaucer vibes.
Yeah, we discussed Chaucer, didn't we? It's Chaucer's London. And actually, I remember in the Museum of London, there are some, if you look at all the paintings from before the Great Fire, you get a sense of the claustrophobia and just wood. Lots of wood.
It's got wood. But the fire swept that all away. It burned down 13,200 houses, 87 churches, 52 livery companies.
Yikes.
Which is significant. And obviously courts, jails, and essentially basically the entire infrastructure of the city was
gone,
swept away. And so the character of the city is changed fundamentally and forever by this incident. After, we obviously start to rebuild, and people were anxious to do that. The effect of the fire was that you had a refugee population.
Yeah.
I think it was about 85% of the population of London was displaced and were living in camps, most of them, outside the city walls in places like Shoreditch and Islington and things like that, which is just a wild thought. And this was for, you know, that was the case for a year or two afterwards.
At least, I'd say, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I imagine lots of people up sticks and moved to other cities.
Yeah, I think a lot of the population was just displaced or moved on. Because the next priority was, of course, to just survive.
Yeah.
And for some people, that meant going back into the city and rebuilding. And for others, it would have meant just getting the fuck out. The experience of going back into the city and trying to rebuild as soon as possible was one that happened to quite a lot of people, I think. But the government had to get on top of that quite quickly.
Because people were trying to build themselves bigger houses.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it was always as big.
Yeah, I always had this entire block to myself.
I always had a hot tub.
Yeah.
Yeah. So people moved back, were going back in and were trying to rebuild their houses. And a lot of the time, that was not to code, if you will. Because what came in after the fire, quite quickly, by February 1667... so only, you know, 6 months later, was the Rebuilding of London Act.
Okay, what did that dictate?
So that dictated a few fundamental rules by which everyone had to adhere for the rebuilding of the city.
No hot tubs.
No open fires.
But genuinely no thatch, right?
No thatch, very little wood. All buildings had to be built of brick. I think pretty much stone. All buildings within the city had to be built of brick. They had to be built at a distance from one another across streets. So that historic, you know, format of like overhanging buildings that were like, oh, let's get super close when a fire galleried? Happens.
What are they called?
Jettied.
Jettied.
Is what you're thinking of. Okay. Yeah.
It's so funny because basically when you look at images of that, you've got a house at the bottom, two houses that look like fairly decent distance apart. But as you just go upwards, they get closer and closer together until they basically meet over the street at the top. Yeah.
Get more and more fire problematic.
Yeah.
It's like in the streets in York, aren't there? They're still like that. Is it the Shambles?
The Shambles, yeah.
You've still got styles like that. So that was the Rebuilding of London Act. And obviously, along with that, there was some very significant other builds happening. Christopher Wren and Robert Hooke, who were members of the Royal Society, which is basically the Science Academy of Britain, were given the opportunity to rebuild London and its, you know, significant buildings, mostly churches, but also some other big stuff.
And streets, the layout, right?
Yeah, they had a big plan for how they could make the layout very impressive and sort of mirror the like boulevards and avenues of some of the major European capitals.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for them, London didn't really take to that idea.
No.
Because they were, the priority was to rebuild and to get people and the city moving again. And so the idea of leveling whole sort of street plans and completely up sticks, everything was not conducive to that.
So in spite of the fact that the fire decimated most of the city of London, the sort of original blueprint of this rabbit warren, these winding streets, these interconnected tiny alleys, actually kind of still maintained in spite of their best efforts.
Totally. And it's something that you can still see today if you look at the city of London. The sort of wacky layout is, well, it defies all logic.
Yeah.
And I love it for that.
Yeah, it's great.
So who needs an avenue? Easy. Who needs a boulevard?
It's always great in London when you're rolling around and you're like, where I've never been in this little place before. What is this court that I find myself in?
Totally. So that was, I suppose, the rebuilding of London. Obviously, we've got some very significant buildings that came about in this time.
Well, we've got the Monument to the Great Fire of London.
The Monument?
Known as the Monument to the Great Fire of London. completed in 1677. Yep. So it's 202 metres high. And if you lay it down, you know what I'm saying here.
If you were to lay it down,
the tip of it would hit in a certain direction where the fire started in Pudding Lane. And so the fire would have been a harrowing and traumatic episode for Londoners, but the official human toll, well, official human toll,
yeah,
surprisingly low.
Six is what the city authorities reported.
Yeah.
Which seems improbable,
yeah,
doesn't it, given...
So what happens next? We are in the late 1600s.
Can I just quickly give a shout out to St. Paul's Cathedral?
Please do.
We feel remiss to not mention that one of the most famous buildings to be rebuilt after the fire was the new St. Paul's Cathedral.
I think we spoke about this, that we went from a spire to a dome, right?
Yes, we did. Used to have a very tall spire reaching all the way up to the heavens. But the new style, the Baroque style, I think, that Wren designed in, was the now still standing beautiful domed structure of St. Paul's. He did that. Hook did the monument. He was the architect of the monument.
Okay.
Yeah. We should go up the monument sometime.
We should.
You can, can't you?
Oh, you can.
Yeah, I would love to.
Narrow.
Although it doesn't really tower over the city like it once did.
No, once the tallest building in London.
Yeah.
Or structure in London.
Really stood out because it was such a low-rise city. But now
I love when you're looking at London, you still, especially in a really, really crisp, sunny day, the top of the monument will just sort of glint and you kind of like didn't see it originally and then you're like, ah, there it is.
Yeah. It's like a fire. It's like fire. It's like a matchstick though amongst all the other buildings around it these days.
It is.
Anyway, let's do that.
So what happens next? We're in the late 1600s, and despite the ravages of the fire, London rises anew. Once again, London bounces back to its commercial. It's a period of commercial might that we're heading into. 1694 saw the establishment of the Bank of England.
Probably a very good indicator of the commercial might, yes.
Yeah, that was largely to fund the King's Wars on the continent. The British East India Company, which had been operating for the best part of a century, was also expanding its influence as England's largest corporation. And so because of that, London becomes the hub for imports from India and the Far East, which those imports are then re-exported to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And so this is London getting super rich. This is sort of the beginning of...
Yes, kind of...
Avarice.
Yeah, sort of...
In terms of London.
Sort of harvesting and pillaging from our colonies and taking it all in and putting a tax and marking up everything and then exporting it to the world.
Yeah.
Ain't colonialism profitable?
Yeah. And that obviously, you know, has a profound impact on the makeup of the city.
Yes.
The demographic.
Yes. So we're going into the 18th century now then.
Okay.
The 1700s.
We're making it through.
We should probably mention it's a period known as the Georgian period.
Georgian.
because most of the kings were called George.
Yeah.
So in this period, as we go into the 18th century, London is continuing to grow steadily beyond the bounds of the old square mile. And it's absorbing surrounding green space into areas now that we would see the West End. So the area of Hyde Park and Marylebone to the west and the north. And that west...
Marylebone.
Sorry. You're absolutely right.
Marylebone.
Marylebone.
Excuse me?
That's a bit... Yeah.
Can't say that anymore.
And that western expansion owed a great deal to the Great Fire, because after the Great Fire, you saw a period of intense speculation and building by property developers, because, of course, shit had been burned down. So yeah, we needed to rebuild and build.
But they loved it.
And I think also because of the new laws, you would have seen the need to find more space. Just on a fundamental architectural level, it's mm-hmm. like, you can't build shit as close anymore, so you're going to need to spread out.
So start spreading out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There was an imperative that was legally binding. Mm-hmm. and obviously the West was a nice, easy expansion zone. Beautiful as well. You know, it was formerly like green fields and market gardens. So I'm sure everyone's like, yeah, I'd like to live in
the West. Yeah,
yeah, sure. I'd live down there.
Yeah.
Much nicer. So in that time, you found all these new sort of, not even suburbs, but like areas cropping up. Wealthy landowning families owned this area. So you had the Grosvenors, the Devonshires, but, you know, these lords of. And they were selling or developing their real estate and putting houses, building houses, having houses built on it. And that's when you saw some of these beautiful squares and areas of housing crop up that you can still see today. North of the city, you also saw Shoreditch and Old Street start to be built up and developed. Those used to be, you know, liberties before the Great Fire. They were places that people had started to expand already, but they were starting to see much more development. And to the east, beyond the Tower, you were also seeing stuff cropping up alongside the Thames, which one day would become the Docklands.
The Docklands, indeed. But, Wapping area, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and Limehouse and Shadwell.
Yeah.
Those places. What about south?
South, lest we forget.
Lest we forget the dearest South London.
The settlement of Southwark, the hub of South London, just on the other side of London Bridge, which actually, for the most part, escaped the ravages of the Great Fire. Jump the Thames. Like,
Thames too big,
thank God.
I wonder if the fire hit London Bridge at all.
Yes, it did definitely get onto the bridge, but it was only one end. I don't think it managed to go all the way. And obviously, as we know, Southwark survived it.
So all the residents of South London were...
Yes.
Got away with that one.
That looks shit.
And that's why I'm not a North Londoner.
Yeah, and that's why. So that area continued to grow and thrive. You know, they didn't have the hiccup that was the Great Fire of London. And if anything, it became sort of more of a focus of the Port of London system as well in that period after the fire. So into the 18th century.
We're already there.
But for a flavour of, beyond the expansion of the city that we've just outlined, for a flavour of the time we're in, you want to picture, you know, this is the era of highwaymen. Like Dick Turpin.
Yeah.
Jack Shepherd, the famous young thief.
Yeah. What was he famous for, Jack Shepherd?
He escaped the famous Newgate prison, which mm-hmm. is London's most significant prison, I think like 5 times. And Newgate was not somewhere you escaped.
He definitely knew someone on the inside. He definitely had a distant relative that worked at the prison that was just letting him out.
Well, he was like 12 years old. So I think he probably
Sneaky
just found
little
ways.
Little guy.
Absolutely. And like, God knows when he was first committed.
When he was 4.
I picture his 4-year-old. He escaped on a milkmaid's teat.
So which artist can we look to for this?
So if you can't picture any of those characters we've already mentioned, you can, I'm sure, or may be able to look up the paintings and pictures of Hogarth. Famous depictions of A Harlot's Progress, The Rake's Progress.
Gin Lane.
The Thieves' Den. These were painted by Hogarth and were seen as, or can be seen as, sort of holding up a mirror to the city in this period.
Yeah,
which isn't necessarily the most flattering mirror.
No, they're very vivid, these images, and perhaps because of these gin-soaked vagrants.
Yes.
In 1974, London got its own professional police force in the form of the Bow Street Runners.
Did you just say 1974?
1749. Sorry. London didn't have a police force until
the 70s. No wonder it was so shabby.
Thank you. Thank you for calling me out. Jeez, I need a cup of tea already. So prior to the Bow Street Runners establishment, law enforcement was in the hands of normal folk
every
like
day,
you and me.
Everyday folk.
Which led to quite a lot of corruption and abuse.
It did. The old form of law enforcement was that if somebody did something wrong, you would shout, "Stop, thief!" Specifically if they'd stolen something, obviously. And everybody was legally obliged to drop what they were doing and chase the thief. That is how
often it worked. Did that happen?
Fair. I wouldn't have.
I'm thinking of costermongers being like, I'm not leaving my stall.
But it's like legally, everyone has to muck in.
You didn't chase down the thief.
Yeah.
The thief got off scot-free.
Yeah.
You're going to jail, mate. Yeah. You're going to Newgate.
Well, the other one was murder. That was the other cry.
What are you supposed to do
and
about
then
that?
And then I definitely think twice about
running,
chasing that
yeah,
guy.
I'm not running towards him. Murder! No thanks.
Yeah. And later, we would of course see the establishment of an even more comprehensive police offering. But these guys were the first ones to sort of, the first to do it.
So I'm going to go somewhere else now.
Please.
For 600 years, London had one bridge.
That is wild, isn't it?
Or when I say London, the closest bridge to London Bridge was Kingston. So in 1750, Westminster Bridge is completed, finally, after 100 years or so of wrangling over the topic. The reason that there was 100 years of negotiations is because the watermen, the Thames watermen or lightermen,
yeah,
who ferried people, both cargo and people, south to north, north to south, but then also along the Thames would have been chock full of watermen.
Yeah, it was a highway, wasn't it?
They obviously resisted the building of a new bridge because they didn't want to go out of work.
Totes.
And I mean, their fears were valid.
Vividly realised.
The move prompted the City of London to widen and remove buildings from London Bridge. And then a flurry of bridges then followed. Kew in 1759, Blackfriars in 1769, Battersea, Richmond. It was a bridge boom, a veritable bridge boom.
Yeah.
But I just think it's crazy to think that for 600 years it was just
the only crossing point that you could, yeah, it was London Bridge. I mean, can you imagine the traffic?
Don't.
The morning traffic.
Don't. I mean, there might as well only be one bridge in London now, frankly.
Yeah, right, the vibe.
They're all friggin' closed.
I mean, the tit for tat is so funny of that experience as well. It's how, like, Westminster finally builds a bridge. And obviously, we talked about the West-East tension already. We need to sort our bridge out now.
Exactly.
Need to keep business coming into the city and not going west. And then they build Blackfriars, which is specifically a City of London bridge as well. So yeah, there's this just funny sort of tit for tat between East and West there.
And so more bridges, more access, greater growth and expansion.
Yes.
And so, I mean, I know this is, all these bridges meant that London, I mean, I know it's a theme of most cities in the world, but a big theme of London is growth.
Mm-hmm.
And so the city is now, as you were talking about earlier, it's really growing beyond its ancient boundaries. It's getting big.
Yeah. The access that bridges afforded meant suddenly people could just countenance living in other places outside of it. Right?
The sprawl begins.
Yeah. With that growth comes the need to organise things a bit more and administer in a more detailed way. And the government at this point starts to fund public services a bit more. I'm talking about things like paving roads, going from sort of dirt tracks to something a little bit more shishy. Lighting for streets, drainage, of course, is important. And in 1774, we have the London Building Act, which is a really interesting little act.
Please tell me how interesting it is.
I will. So, you know Georgian houses?
I know a few.
Can you picture them?
Yes, I can.
Can you tell me some of the stylistic features that you'd associate with a Georgian house?
the semicircular top of the window.
Is that a fan window?
Fan window. I always think that.
Yeah, maybe
one. Pillars outside, steps up to it.
Mm-hmm.
White,
the big ones. Yeah, yeah, the big ones, absolutely.
What else? You tell me.
Well, they're almost all made of London stock brick, which is that yellow brick, which is made of London clay. That's why it's that colour.
Uh-huh.
And they're sort of quite symmetrical often. Square windows, often cut into smaller squares. That's a classic Georgian house. And the London Building Act prescribed a set of sort of rates of Georgian buildings or Georgian houses, and going from sort of 1, 2, 3, 4. And this was basically size and expense related. And you can see the fancy versions with the columns and the steps in places as diverse as sort of Camberwell, Bloomsbury, Hackney. But you can also see smaller examples as well, because that was how London was basically codified. Its building and architecture was codified in that era.
So you have to build buildings that look the same.
Exactly. It was a law. So that was...
'Tis the law.
Yes. So all of London was built up.
Do you think
like
someone
that.
Could shout, that person's not built their house the same style as me? And then all the locals would go and just take the building down.
I don't think it ever got that bad.
No, because the Bow Street Runners existed by then, so...
Yeah. So another character of the city note, something you can still see today, and actually once, or for a good chunk of London's history, was the uniform style of housing. And people used to talk about it. Some talked about it as beautiful. Others talked about it as very boring and uniform.
I think it's beautiful.
In small doses, I think it is beautiful. But you can imagine if the entire city was just flat, sort of, you know, consistent rows of those houses, then maybe it would get a little dull.
Potentially.
Yeah. So that does Georgian housing.
We have arrived in Victorian London. Ready to get drunk as a boiled owl on Battle TB? Well, you're in the right place. This is Victorian London. This is Queen Victoria's London, Dickens London, and a hugely iconic period in the city's history. The idea of Victorian London is probably still kind of like a tourist attraction somehow.
Certainly some of the major tourist attractions in London are Victorian.
So at the turn of the century, in 1801, the first reliable census of London's population recorded over 1 million souls, which made it the largest metropolis in the world, at the centre of an empire which ruled, what is it, a third of the globe?
Yes.
So we're basically saying, like, London has become the preeminent city of the world.
The capital of the world.
We said it.
I'm sure the Americans would take issue.
Not at this time.
No.
Not in the Victorian period. They would now.
Yes.
But we're not talking about now.
No, we're not.
Sorry, I'll calm down. Okay, first up, the first big change in Victorian London. Locomotives. Do the locomotive, Louis.
Choo-choo.
Thank you. Big industrial icon. That's actually quite good. In 1837, Euston became London's first mainline station. I should have asked that as a question, shouldn't I?
Yes.
Louis, what was London's first mainline station?
I believe it was Euston.
How did you know?
I can tell you where it landed too, where it went.
Please do.
The first railway line to Birmingham.
Yeah.
Came from Euston.
Yeah. And then in terms of stations, Euston was followed by Paddington, Waterloo, King's Cross, all within 50 years. So we're connecting London to the rest of the country here and its own ever-expanding suburbs.
Mm.
Next up, mode of transportation. How do you make a sound of a boat?
It's the docks and shipping.
Docks and shipping. The dock complex to the east of the city, handling huge quantities of goods from across Britain's empire, expanded at crazy, dizzying pace. And with an increasingly busy and congested Thames, the massive new West India docks were built at the turn of the century. And in their wake came the East India docks and then St. Catherine's docks.
All servicing the places that they were named after, other than St. Catherine's.
In order to connect all the docks together and to the rest of the country, Regent's Canal is built. And that ran from, still does run from Limehouse Basin to Paddington. And then it joins up with the Grand Union Canal, which then goes
all the way up to Birmingham
and beyond to Manchester.
Yes, although it might, that might be a different section of canal.
Probably is, but
Yes, they all interconnect and allow you to travel all the way up the country with your goods.
This is a slightly dense comment, but canals are amazing, man.
Man, not dense at all. They really are.
So cool.
They were the main mode of haulage in a pre-industrial world. And it's an amazing thing.
God love him. God love Mr. Canal. tell us what happened after that.
The Docklands as an area, because of all of this new infrastructure that's built up, is booming. More people than ever flooding to that area where there was a lot of work that obviously came with the building up of that, of the docks. And the East End becomes incredibly densely populated.
This is where the East End starts to take shape.
Yes.
In a way that we might recognize today.
Yes. This is the birth of the working class East End.
Yeah.
And in the previous century, the population of the city grew by 500,000 across 100 years, which, you know, is pretty impressive. But not as impressive as the 19th century, where we went from 1 million people, million souls, remember,
souls.
At the start,
to how many souls?
To 6.7 million by the end of the 19th century.
You say it's impressive, it's also kind of terrifying.
It's a little worrying. And we'll get into that.
Sorry, that made me sound like anti-immigration. That's not what I meant at all. What I meant was just like human capacity to multiply is just kind of alarming sometimes.
Absolutely. And also a city whose infrastructure hadn't changed a lot in terms of its ability to support human beings and life suddenly had a lot more on its plate.
Yeah.
Right? That is a worry. But we'll think about it. We'll get to it.
Okay.
London did. An element of this boom in population also was that there was regular migration to the city. It wasn't just people being born. There was lots of migration. You had regional migration within the United Kingdom from the home counties and elsewhere, coming to the city for work, of course. There was also immigration. Some of the significant chapters in like global history that fed this. In Ireland, there was the Great Famine. 1845.
And the Irish settlers, quite a lot of them gravitated towards the area known as St. Giles in the centre of London.
Yes.
In the West End of London.
Yes. It's worth noting that the Irish obviously had an incredibly unpleasant period in their history then. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them went to the New World. A section, however, fled the disastrous and horrendous things that were going on in Ireland because of the famine, came to London. And yes, settled in the area of the present day Tottenham Court Road.
Yeah, St. Giles.
So that area was very Irish. By 1861, there was one in all 20, in every 20 Londoners was Irish. Later in the century, there was an influx of Russian Jews who were fleeing anti-Semitic pogroms. They settled in the east around Whitechapel, Aldgate, Spitalfields. A lot of them set up businesses. A lot of them were very prosperous. And that saw a lot of them moving into leafier, more salubrious suburbs like Dalston, Stoke Newington, Stamford Hill.
There's a small but very distinct Italian community emerging in Soho.
Uh-huh.
And in Limehouse, there were a lot of Chinese immigrants. And actually, that Limehouse became known as London's first Chinatown because the Chinese sailors settled there. On the subject of sailors, sailors from India and black members of England's military who had initially arrived in London in the 18th century started to integrate into existing communities in places like Mile End, Stepney, Paddington. But of course, they faced some of the hardest living conditions in the city.
Interesting on the topic of, you know, what makes up a London, what makes up London, what makes a Londoner, as we talked about back in the first episode. The demographic is obviously still predominantly white British in this period, in the Victorian period, but there was a huge amount of immigration to the city, and, you know, there was a great variety and a great diversity already in what makes a Londoner.
Victorian London is synonymous with poverty, I think, to a degree.
Definitely a thread, a famous thread.
Dire poverty. Yeah. And greedy private landlords packed existing housing, which was ill-equipped to accommodate the number of tenants occupying it, packed it to the rafters, leading to major overcrowding and woeful slum conditions in the inner city.
Yeah, which is the result of the city population booming.
Yeah.
Where are we going to put them all?
You tell me.
Old housing, ill-equipped.
Just pack them in.
Yeah.
Sadly.
And that's the situation, you know. Private landlords who own these houses, greedy private landlords.
Yeah, and obviously here is something emerging. Well, it's been present in London for a while, but what begins to emerge is this huge contrast between rich and poor. And a good example of this is, while one part of London society enjoyed the pageantry and grandeur of the Great Exhibition in Hyde Park.
1851.
One of your faves.
Love it.
Or they enjoyed the newly booming entertainment districts of the West End, you know. Mm. I'm thinking Regent Street, you know, I'm thinking Piccadilly, I'm thinking going to the theatre, all that kind of stuff. Just streets away, another demographic of people lived in the most abject poverty. London's wealth divide is still apparent today. However, it's just during that period in the 19th century, it's at its most prominent, really. Mm. Witnesses to this huge gulf in living conditions, Edwin Chadwick, Octavia Hill, Charles Booth, and Charles Dickens. And they were instrumental in highlighting the poverty crisis, which in turn helped lead to systematic changes. Dickens wrote in the papers about a particularly destitute slum a few hundred yards away from Westminster Abbey and the Houses of Parliament, which he named the Devil's Acre, and I'll read it. As the brightest lights cast the deepest shadows, so are the splendours and luxuries of the West End found in juxtaposition with the most deplorable manifestations of human wretchedness and depravity.
Yeah, that's not very nice, is it?
He's not mincing his words there, is he?
No, he's not. No, he's not. Now, we talked, didn't we, before about London sort of catching up with itself in this regard, and in the face of this huge growth in the city's population, some serious public service issues were sort of beginning to manifest, and they needed to have a big old update to the system. So in 1855, we saw the establishment of the Metropolitan Board of Works. Boring sounding update, but that was essentially the first time that the city tried to bring together all of the administration and management of its infrastructure and the logistics and all the rest of it.
How does this differ from what you talked about in the Georgian period, where they're updating lighting, pavements, drainage? What's this? What's the difference?
So this is a board. This is an actual sort of committee for it. Right. Whereas previously the government, I think, probably in a slightly more ad hoc way, was getting involved in those things. Whereas the Board of Works were a government body.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the bods.
Yeah. So they would be focusing on a lot of the things that we heard about before. Drainage. Street improvements, building regulations. So yeah, definitely in the legacy of that same thing.
While we're on drainage,
yeah,
do you want to talk about something that's not very glam, but is it makes London work?
It's an impressive and very, very important thing.
The sewer system.
Abso-bloody-lutely. So chief engineer of the Metropolitan Board of Works, newly established Metropolitan Board of Works, was a guy who you may have heard of. He's a guy called Joseph Basil Getty?
Yeah.
Basil Getty? No, he's not French.
I think
Basil Getty. Now, Joseph Basil Getty was a smart cookie. He really was. And
oh, you knew him?
No, but I know his work.
Right.
Not too intimately. Now, in the
we all know his work. We do.
We do. In the face of epidemics that were happening in the city, diphtheria, cholera, all those delightful things, there was the need and the recognition of the need to get to grips with sanitation. So one of the notable things alongside that was the fact that the Thames absolutely stank. Like you knew when you were near the Thames in the mid-Victorian period. in this period, you started to hear about something called the sanitary idea, which in the 1850s, I suppose, medically and scientifically, began to take hold, and people started to understand that filth, dirt, these things would cause illness.
Yeah, because before that, they sort of believed in the miasma theory, right?
Yes.
Which
an
was...
an ancient theory that air, smelly air, could make you ill.
Yeah?
Miasma means bad air. So that theory was still kind of holding sway until the mid-Victorian period, when they did start to realise, oh, actually, maybe if we, like, leave the streets, you know, like, running with shit, people are going to get ill. Or at least the river. So Basil Getty, as the head engineer of the Board of Works, said, all right, how are we going to deal with this? We're going to completely update the sewer system of the city. And we're going to build a sewer system that is going to funnel waste, not straight into the River Thames from people's privies, but further down the river, beyond the main city of London, beyond the square mile.
Just not in London. Let's just take it to another part of the UK.
Yeah, so let's funnel it down to beyond the Docklands.
Tilbury,
yeah. Kent.
Okay. Let's give it to Essex.
And so that huge project saw the development and the creation of new embankments to house these massive new sewer pipes. And they really were massive. The embankments that we know today of Victoria, Chelsea, Albert embankments, those are part of our sewer system.
What I love about this is that they're some of the more kind of picturesque, shiny
Beautiful. Bits
of London built on shit.
They are built on pipes of shit, yeah. They are literally, that's what runs through them.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, big up the sewer system, because only... today, or only right now, are we seeing... I'm serious.
No, I know, but I just think it's funny. Like, did you ever think a while ago that one day you'd be recording a podcast talking about sewers?
I never knew how much I'd care. That's for sure. So just until just now, when the Tideway project, London super sewer upgrade, which is happening and has been happening for what feels like a lifetime... that is the first upgrade that the London sewage system has seen since Basil Getty did his thing in the mid-19th century.
What you're kind of getting at here is that Basil Getty's got a pitch for most iconic Londoner.
He's definitely in my top 10.
He got his hands dirty for our pleasure.
Pleasure?
For our comfort.
For our greater comfort.
For our greater comfort.
Of both our noses and our immune systems.
And health.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow, we spent a lot of time talking about...
big up. So let's move or stay in the subterranean.
Let's continue underground,
yes,
shall we?
In the subterranean.
Should we go deeper?
Let's go a bit deeper.
In 1863, we get something marginally less smelly, but, you know, not much. The installation of the first underground railway in the world in order to ease horse-drawn traffic congestion on the roads above it. Yes, ladies and gentlemen... the tube.
It's the tube. Back then known as something else.
The underground locomotive or something like that, wasn't it? And where did it run from? It's always a good pub quiz question, this.
Farringdon to Paddington.
Yeah. Initially.
It's just east to west, basically.
Initially, that was it. But it was a great success.
Yeah.
And it soon extended out to Hammersmith and much further beyond in the future, as we all know.
Yes.
But 1863 was when it all kicked off.
It's amazing. Was it underground? It was steam railways at first, and then they electrified it not too long after that.
Yeah, it's pretty astonishing. Sick. We had a second bridge boom around this time. London got even more bridges. The watermen by this point must be incensed.
The watermen are supposed to be packing it in.
Yeah, I think they've become people that work on bridges.
Yeah.
So along with new versions of the old London Bridge and Westminster Bridge and Blackfriars Bridge, there was Waterloo, Vauxhall, Southwark, Chelsea, Lambeth, Wandsworth, and of course, in 1894, Tower Bridge.
Notably, the only one east. All the rest were
east of London
Western.
Bridge. Yeah. Well, that still baffles me that there's no bridge. I suppose it gets too wide, but there's no bridge east of Tower Bridge until you get to the Dartford Crossing.
There's a very interesting video about that on YouTube by that guy who does really fun bite-sized history. I'll send it to you.
Please do.
There are actually projects looking at trying to do like underground bike lanes and all sorts, but none of them have taken off. Mm. So we've had all of those new bridges. let's talk about another iconic image of Victorian London, and that is smoke.
Yes, well, Tower Bridge veiled in smoky smokeness is, yeah, that's the look.
Yeah. In this period, not only did you have quite a lot of industry in the city still, lots of it to the south of the river, the south and certainly the Docklands was, you know, the sort of factory workhouse area of the city. There was also heavy atmospheric pollution caused by the burning of soft coal as a domestic heating method. Now, soft coal is basically sort of like powdered, crappy, cheap coal. And in this period, you started to hear the expression, the famous epithet, the big smoke. The infamous pea soup fogs came around in this period.
It's a pea super.
Exactly. Those were caused by a mixture of soot from the burning of soft coal and industry, and sulfur dioxide combining with damp air, which we get quite a lot of because we're in the Thames Valley. So damp air settles in and around London. And at their worst, these pea supers, they saw mortality rates in the city spike. The old and the young probably the most susceptible to sort of respiratory issues. And in later down the line, you'll see the sort of the Great Smog, which happened in the 1950s, so quite a way down.
The Great Smog.
Yeah, and that was a really ugly affair. But just sort of the worst of these pea supers, which became very common in this period in history. And it's kind of an iconic look for the city.
It is. And we're almost through Victorian London, but just before the end of the century, we get one of your faves. We get a systems update.
Yeah!
And this is where the Metropolitan Board of Works, for those of you still awake, becomes the London County Council.
Out with the Board of Works, in with the County Council.
The LCC.
What year was that?
1888.
An auspicious year for administration.
Yeah. Yeah, sure, man. And unlike the Board of Works, the LCC ushered in a new age of administrative involvement in the day-to-day life of the city, and they took over all the same functions as the Board of Works, but added things like schools and asylums, the asylum and the workhouse being Victorian London staples.
Mm.
And in time, it would also be the LCC's responsibility to oversee the building of social housing for the poor and those displaced by slum clearances, to make way for bigger and better builds.
Or not.
Or not, as the case
may be. It's a little way down the road, isn't it? But yeah, the LCC's legacy is something you can still see today. If you see any of those old Victorian schoolhouses, of which there are many in London.
And many now converted into really nice flats.
Yeah. A lot of them will have the sort of London School Board engraving on the side of the building. And that the London School Board was a function of the LCC.
Yeah.
An iconic administration.
1888 was also the year of the Whitechapel murders, or the Jack the Ripper murders,
yeah,
where a number of women were brutally murdered in London's East End, around obviously Whitechapel, Brick Lane.
Yeah.
The mystery remained unsolved, and it sort of shone a light on the murky depths of London's East End.
Yeah.
It captured the imagination of the media as one of the sort of original true crime events, and as a result captured the imagination of Londoners, and it continues to be a source of tourism basically for people today.
Yeah, I've been on one of those tours.
Have you?
Yeah, it's gross. Don't go.
No, I won't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, speaking of famous characters from that period, same kind of time that Conan Doyle was writing up Mr. Sherlock Holmes and his accomplice Watson.
A very famous fictional Londoner.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose kind of capturing the tone of the period more than anything, in both fact, in the case of Jack the Ripper, and fiction in the form of Sherlock Holmes.
This is true Victoriana.
Yes, Victoriana, exactly. This is when, at the sort of tail end of the period, it's getting sort of fictionalized and codified and turned into the sort of black,
bloody,
smoggy, moody environment and mindset that we all kind of place Victorian London in today.
Yeah.
So, as we come to the end of the 19th century and the end of the Victorian period, we have been bequeathed a London that you would probably recognise in many parts today.
What if you were dropped into it?
Yeah.
Of course you would.
the image of, you know, street lamp lined roads, plane trees, a lot of these iconic
smog
London vibes, less the smog, we've dealt with that a bit better, but certainly the architectural legacy in terms of the suburbs of London, most of the sprawling suburbia of London, inner London specifically, but also going out, was built in the Victorian period. It was a huge time of growth for the city.
Added to that, so many of London's most famous landmarks are from the Victorian period. Mm-hmm. We've got Big Ben, Tower Bridge, Trafalgar Square, the National Gallery, the V&A, the Natural History Museum. They all crop up in the Victorian period. So, and the sewers.
Yes.
God bless the Victorians.
For their work
on London.
Meaty, though. Meaty section of London history.
Meaty. So meaty that I'm going to need a cup of tea.
Yeah, I think it might be time for another break.